Hello. Thank you for listening to K Voice of Resistance. That's the letter K, Voice of Resistance. I'm your host, Kelly. This episode was actually recorded at 4:48 p.m. September 3rd. I'm in Vietnam right now. So I pre-recorded an interview with activist Jimmy Keane Bolt. Next week will be the start of my Disaster Capitalism series, which is more important now than ever. Enjoy the show.
Well, I'm Jimmy Keane Bolt, and, you know, I guess, you know, my whole life, even though I'm 64, has had a lot of activism and marching. I guess I'll take you back to 1963, which is the Martin Luther King March on Washington. It's also the year that Kennedy was killed in November. And so there were a lot of turbulent events, and maybe fast forward, I would have been in high school in 1968
when Luther King,
both Martin Luther King was killed and Robert Kennedy, and the Vietnam War was in full force. And so that's really my coming of age years, was with the Vietnam War. And so we were out on the streets protesting. I remember I turned 18. I was part of the draft that year. I was in college. I remember that day very well, you know, not knowing if I was going to be sent off to Vietnam and fight this war that we already all knew was not a moral war. And I remember my girlfriend running through the campus towards me because she had found out that I was like number 260. And so I knew there'd be, and she knew there'd be no way I could be drafted, because I think that year they went up to 112 or something. They would just pick out different birthdays. June 12th would be draft number one, and they just like the lottery. Although you didn't win a very good prize. You know, so that was going on in college. The war ended. Being gay, you know, so much of my life has been a battle about getting ever more increasing rights within our society here. I grew up in Wisconsin, and so, you know, there were no gay people, I thought, around. Only to find out when I did go to my first gay bar in Madison at the university, I found out there was a gay bar in my hometown the whole time. But you know, I had to leave the Midwest to be comfortable, because you really couldn't lead a gay lifestyle. I can't believe that word came out of my mouth. A gay lifestyle in the Midwest and in the middle 70s. And so I lived in Chicago for a few years. I have a degree in microbiology and public health, so I've always been also involved in the public health side of matters, and have always done volunteer work at health clinics. And when I was in Chicago, it was like the first development of vaccines around hepatitis B, and I was part of that program. Moved to California, 1979, and very shortly after 1981, I remember one day reading in The Advocate about this new weird disease, and they called it GRIDS. They didn't even have the name of AIDS for it at the time. And I think that's what has interested me in healthcare and the ability of people to be treated, no matter what their means are, throughout the rest of my life, was starting with that, because I really saw so many people suffering on so many different levels. Socially, as far as being ostracized from society or their parents, or not being allowed to be treated in hospitals, the whole gamut. And on top of that, not having insurance. And it's interesting how the Republicans just brought up this thing that they were going to put people with pre-existing conditions into high-risk pools. I remember when they had high-risk pools for people with AIDS in California. And what that meant is your insurance capped out at $50,000, and then you're on your own. And that's the same thing that this plan that they were trying to put through did. You know, they said, oh, it covers pre-existing conditions, and you get to be in a high-risk pool, but you're not covered because it has a max. Unlike Obamacare, or what I prefer to call the ACA, there is no caps, limits for treatment. And so I marched on the streets with ACT UP and the other organizations. For myself personally, I first found out I was HIV positive in 1988. And the reason I never tested, I assumed that it was positive based on my sexual proclivities right away out of the gate. So for me, it was kind of like, you know, the horse was out of the barn by the time that we thought about slamming the gate. But But I never got tested because in those days there was all this discussion, like, would those records be kept confidential? You know, or who would, if you test, who gets those records? Would it be used to discriminate in employment? Because that was another thing, too. It was, you know, people were calling for us to be not allowed to work, and people didn't know how it was transmitted. It was a very scary time for a lot of people. And so, you know, there was really no reason for me to test because there was all those issues with it. And at that time, there's also no medication. So they'd be like, well, why get tested? Because there's nothing to treat. So when their AZT came out, that's when I treated it, found out I was HIV positive. And also, insurance wasn't portable at that point. So, you know, I had good insurance with an employer, but it made me stuck to that job. It really didn't allow me to look outside of that job for advancements and things like that, because there'd be issues like, well, what if your next employer, they don't cover pre-existing conditions? At that point in time, it was like the big Fortune 500 companies that didn't have pre-existing clauses. So if you had a pre-existing condition, if you went to a big company, it would be fine. But smaller companies, you could lose your coverage for that kind of thing. So it kind of kept me more bound. I only ended up with like three different jobs, all of them good, but I was, you know, 15 years in one job, five another, and then 17 years in my last job. And a lot of that stability, which I suppose is good to be stable, was due to the fact that it would be very hard to change jobs with that diagnosis. So after that, it really was more of a quiet period in my life as far as activism. Always, you know, democratic in my voting, but not really involved, not, you know, working to get people elected to office or anything, and just, you know, doing my career thing. And it wasn't until, you know, 2 years ago, I retired when I was 62. Like so many other people, I got re-involved when Donald Trump was elected, you know, and it took me by surprise like it did so many other people. And in one hand, I'm grateful because I do have the time now that I can be involved, which I didn't when I was working, you know, a lot of hours a week. So I'm glad I'm able to do it. And it makes me feel like I'm giving back to the community again. So my initial involvement was I got interested after the election. So I was trying to find an organization to get involved with. You know, I didn't know what to do. I contacted some organizations, like some Democratic clubs offering to volunteer, Stonewall Democratic Club, the Human Rights Organization. And quite honestly, I was pretty disappointed in the responses because I never got any emails back about, well, you could help us or show up here or there to help. They wanted money. That's all they wanted was money. And then in, I think it was December or early January, I was watching Rachel Maddow, and that's the first time I heard about Indivisible. So I got online and I typed in Indivisible, and it just so happened that in the Indivisible group was just about morphing to join into another group called Courageous Resistance. And then that's really, since January, I started going to the meetings and getting more and more involved in that group. And within that group, I was part of a group that focused on healthcare issues. And, you know, this is the last 6 months have been, that was like the first hit item I think they were after. And I'm very pleasantly pleased. Yeah, I'm grateful that with all the people across the states and the world, I think, being active, we were able to prevent Obamacare from being repealed. You know, for me right now, I think the battle right now, the immediate battle is to make sure that Donald Trump does not defund what's in place for Obamacare and to get these exchanges healthy again, because there are issues. There, you know, the insurance is going way up in places in these exchanges, but it's probably going up less actually with Obamacare than it would have been if the ACA had not been enacted, because the rises in pricing is a lot around the other problems in our healthcare system with have nothing to do with the insurance, and that's around the number of doctors we have, nurses, clinics, you know, hospital. There's a shortage of all those things, you know, and the population is aging, so we need, you know, people to take care of old people, and there's not a lot of money in old people. Doctors really can't specialize in gerontology because they only get paid by Social Security, and they can get made a lot more money, you know, treating cancer I'm not saying that people that treat cancer are doing it for the money, but it, like everyone else, we all have to pay our bills. So that's what I'm fighting for first and foremost right now. I've also gotten involved in a candidacy for state senate, a woman that's running for state senate. That's really becoming gratifying for me also. It's just really a good way to flow the energy in and out of my body, the anger and rage that I see around me all the every day and on TV, and be able to channel it through myself in a way to help people. Turn that anger into hope, I guess.
It is my high honor and distinct privilege to introduce to you the President-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
The night of the election, I was shocked. I don't think I can describe it any more than that. Kind of disbelief of what happened. Disbelief that he could be elected to the United States with all the issues that were brought up from, especially his treatment of women. And I don't know how anybody, a man could vote for him because they have daughters, and how a woman could vote for him because they're a woman. I didn't get that part of it. For me, that even though he was a non-deal from the very beginning, I don't see how anybody after that interview from Entertainment Weekly came out could possibly support him. And I think that just says a lot about our society and the value of women in our society still. And, well, it's painful to even talk about that. It wasn't angry. It was just shock and disbelief. And then that shock turned to anger. I think what I became angriest the most about is people who, before the election, had kind of like said, well, there's really no difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. It doesn't matter. I'm either going to not vote, or I'm going to vote for these libertarians, or I'll even vote for Jill Stein, maybe. You know, I'll throw away my vote because it doesn't matter if Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump wins. Hope she wins, but I don't want to be part of that election itself. And so I hope you're all happy with yourselves. And I shouldn't be bitter, but I guess I am bitter. And I think through time now, it's just come out, although people still don't want to say that the influence of the Russians on the election changed the election, I have come to the conclusion that it has. And if you look at the states and how the Electoral College came out, and how the difference in Pennsylvania, per se, the difference from the day before the last statement that Comey came out about her emails again, and she was like 12 or like 20 points ahead in Philadelphia and suburbs. And then after that week, after that whole email thing, one more time, she was down and she lost it, you know, by the margin. I think she still won some of those suburbs, but the margin it was down would have carried Pennsylvania. And it's true in Michigan. It's true in Wisconsin. You know, like in Michigan and Wisconsin, the number of votes that Jill Stein got, those votes would have given Hillary Clinton the win in Wisconsin and Michigan. And I would suggest everyone look up, type in Jill Stein sitting at a table with Putin. Go on the internet. If you just type in Jill Stein and Russian connection, she's sitting at that table with him right there. She's part of this whole thing too. I mean, that's, I shouldn't say that. I can't prove it. But the pictures tell a thousand words.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I guess my disbelief, shock, hurt, you know, fear. I guess it would be fear, you know. On my side, it would be the fear of the Republican having all three houses and dismantling Obamacare. Very fearful. I am in good health, but I have a lot of medicals. I go to the doctor a lot of different issues besides just the HIV now. And yeah, that would really change my life if pre-existing conditions weren't covered or all this stuff. So in my personal case, I guess my biggest fears were around continuation of my health care coverage. And just, I guess my other thing is the anger is around, was and still is, the treatment of undocumented people in our country, and how they have been made out to be the bad people and the reason for all the problems in the United States. And that's just so far from the truth. And it just makes me sad. You know, I know the sadness, to cover sadness, we get angry. But if I really sit with it, it's just the inhumanity of it just is, I don't know, you know, what can you say about that? That people can do that to other people and have that kind of hatred. You know, I've been telling people stories about, like, you know, I when I was a kid, like, I didn't think that heaven would be segregated, like, Jews on one side, Mexicans here and there and everything. But, and that's what I've been telling people lately, but about a month ago, I went to Lake Tahoe, and I went up to this town outside of it, and there's this huge cemetery, and they talked about how the Lutherans were buried in this part of the cemetery, and the Catholics over here, and the Irish there, and it all came back to me, because I remember that in my own hometown back in the 50s, people were buried like that in separate groups, and they were not mixed. There were Jewish cemeteries, there were Christian cemeteries, and most of the places, they were not intermingled, and to remember something like that was freaky. And it negated my cute statement I was making to people. So, right, Audrey? Audrey's my dog here. No.
What are your thoughts about a Mike Pence presidency?
Well, I don't think maybe we're going to have to worry about that, because I think he did, unless they're able to shove it under the rug. He's involved in this Russian thing in the beginning, too, somewhat, and this whole thing with Sessions, in some manner. So, I don't know what they're going to be able to cover up and what they're not. But if he is president, although I guess I'd be less worried on the foreign stage of, within the United States, I think he's even worse. He's a known homophobe. You only need to look at what he did to Indiana, and trying to allow people to discriminate against gays, in public workplaces. I mean, as far as giving service to customers, they wouldn't have to serve you. You know, my belief is if you're running a company, a public business, you need to serve everybody. You don't have that right. Even if it's your family business and it's against your Christian beliefs or your whatever beliefs, because I don't want to use the word Christian, religious beliefs, because there's more Christians probably that don't have a problem with gay people than there are that do. So, if that bothers you, that you have to accommodate gay people in a public business, then don't be in business. It's just that simple, right? You have a choice. And then as far as tax cuts and giving money back to the wealthy, I think he's probably even worse than Trump is, any kind of issues like that. And of course, then you go to the next person in line, who is Paul Ryan. Wonderful, good old Paul Ryan. Like I said at the beginning of the interview, I grew up in Wisconsin, so I keep in touch with what our people do, our congressmen. I'm very proud to say that Tammy Baldwin is a state senator, open lesbian from the state of Wisconsin. Proud of that. And through the years, I've always respected Paul Ryan, just because I thought he was a man of principle. I didn't like anything he stood for. I think he wants to take away Social Security, and it really does go back to he believes in the stuff about, everyone takes care of themselves, and if you can't take care of yourself, goodbye, and go down the river and die. But at least I thought he believed in that, and I gave him that benefit. But after this Trump presidency, I have no respect for him now, because he sold his beliefs down the river to, play the game with Trump, just for political survival, I guess is the right way to put it. And he's still that today. I think the most recent statement, he couched it so that he said, I would use different words than Donald Trump on the Charlottesville issue. But there was no condemnation. I think he said, I wouldn't think of it in those terms. Because he's still trying to advance a political agenda more than human rights, allowing people to live with dignity and respect.
His Ayn Randian,
yes,
terrifying nightmare, dystopian future he imagines.
Yeah. So, that's why we're in such a quandary all. I don't know who's next after Paul Ryan.
Hatch.
Orrin Hatch?
Mm-hmm.
I think he's not too bad. He's more from the old guard of he will look for a compromise. I think he has, some of those same crazy positions, but he's, I think, a little more rational, and I don't think it doesn't have to save face, maybe like these younger politicians where they're embedded in their position and he would be able to vote for something that he wasn't 100% agreement with, if there was also something in it that he was in agreement with.
That's kind of my argument for a lot of people are for term limits, and I feel like a lot of the older senators are better at compromise.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they know the system a little better. So they realize what works and what doesn't.
Right.
I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, one of the thoughts I have right now, because getting back involved into politics, please don't repeat this, but I was a young Republican. That was my upbringing. I remember this I was for Ronald Reagan. And
no. Really?
Yeah, I think I stayed that way until my first year in college.
So your family was Republican.
Republican, but in Wisconsin, it's a swing state. So my parents, they voted back and forth. They voted for Kennedy. I think they voted for Reagan. And, you know, I didn't always ask them, but they would look at a person and vote on the issues. And so I always respected them for that. But they were towards fiscally conservative. You know, back in that days, there was a whole wing of the Republican Party called the Rockefeller Ring, people that were very liberal on social issues. And Al Gore would have locked up our Social Security, but, you know, someone dangled their chads all over the place. You know, and that's another one, you know, people, history repeats itself if you don't remember. You know, there again, the difference between Bush and Gore in Florida, those votes were from Nader.
And yeah, that's right.
So there was that spoiler. George Bush would not have been president if Nader hadn't run. And this just repeated itself with Hillary Clinton.
And then there were shenanigans in that election, too.
Oh, yeah. What can we do going forward, huh?
What can we do going forward?
How do we fix this?
Great question. What can we do going forward? I mean, we've got, outside of the activism stuff, right?
Right.
How do we get this country back?
Right.
Just liberals, but as
all of us together, you know, and bring people together. How do we, I'll blame someone. You know, I have to blame the Republicans because they have brought this on. Their politics of fear for years and years, and now they have these people, and they have made these people, I don't even blame the people themselves because they're in that actual fear. They are actually afraid of homosexual. They are actually afraid of black people. They're actually afraid that their jobs are going to go away and no one is going to help them. Their fears are real, but the Republican Party has accelerated that. They make their money off of people's fears because they use those hot button items and then they send them out in envelopes and like help make sure that you don't have a gay couple move in next door to you with their kid. You know, send us $50. And instead of helping to educate people and take those fears away and make their lives more comfortable, they stoke them and try and make them more fearful so they can get money.
Yeah.
So that's got to be stopped. How do we stop that?
That's a great question. How do you get a party that's gone so far and been so successful with negative politics, with the politics of fear? How do you get them to stop? Because the Democrats have a positive message and they're policy-based, and it's simply not as effective.
Right. Yeah.
It's just not. And I don't want us to change. I don't want us to become.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know, the Republicans are so cool with dirty tactics.
Right.
And again, I don't want us to start using dirty tactics, but.
Right. Well, it becomes that middle class again, which I'm surprised, you know, the Republicans are eroding it and eroding it. But those are the people they target them to make them afraid of the people that are in the lower class. So that they're not looking at themselves in the upper class, just, you know, pulling that money out of the system.
You know? So what are they going to do when there's not a middle class anymore? More gerrymandering and more shit like that.
I don't know.
I wonder if the conservative movement now is more, it has shifted to more race and stuff like that. Louder. It's always kind of been, but louder.
Right.
But I wonder
if
they're doing that because there's less middle class to vote for. Because they can win. It's not a winning policy to do this.
Yeah.
Just the economic stuff anymore.
Yeah. But and I guess the other thing that just, while you were talking, I thought of, it's the money that's in politics that is needed to elect people. And the Supreme Court just opened it big time. So as long as that money is in here, in the system, I think it's going to be pretty hard to change stuff.
James Carville said that he thinks the Democrats should run one thing, one issue in 2018, 2020, and that's getting the money out of politics. Because I think that, and he might be right, like, conservatives want that too.
Yeah.
And that, you know, a lot of them do.
Right, yeah. It's the ones that don't is like the Koch brothers or
because they
like
have
that.
The people who have the influence, the money to put in influence.
Right.
And
right.
I would think a lot of politicians would want that too because they spend all their time fundraising.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the money, and locally, I guess the big thing is we've got to take back the governorships. You know, that's a big time for 2018, is to get the governorships.
Then the local state houses.
Yeah.
We'll get people in place in time for the 2020 census and do our own redistricting.
Yeah.
The Republicans are just so smart, and their game plan,
You know, first they did the local and state houses, and then that way they were able to gerrymander the last 10 years. And then their next goal was, well, let's take over the judgeships. They didn't let Obama have his last 100 and something judges, and not just the Supreme Court, but the last lower federal judges. And so now Trump gets to see, what is that, 125 or something?
Right.
Smart. I mean, it's evil.
Yeah, so evil.
Think about how much policy will be made because they have the courts.
Yeah, yeah, and that goes on. And that's what I've heard. That's the reason they kind of embraced him, just for that. Is even if everything else is awful, that was, he at least did that for them. The other thing is, there's a good article in the Washington Post last week about, you know, we all talk about, well, he, you know, he's not been very successful. They weren't able to do health care. Probably won't do this tax reform. But the bigger measure is what Trump has undone, and it's ungodly if you look at the list, and I'll forward you the link for that, of all the things he's done undone, like in the EPA.
Yeah.
And that's why they kept their mouth shut, the Republicans in Congress, because he's doing all that stuff for them.
Definitely,
and,
getting,
you know.
Yeah, the narrative that he's accomplished nothing is a load of crap.
Yeah, he's doing their agenda.
Last question. Okay. What advice would you give to people who they're angry about this and they're on Facebook and stuff, but they don't know what to do?
I think the thing that can be done the easiest is to start making your feelings known to your city councilmen, to your state senators, to your state assembly members. It's the people that you have elected to office. They all have numbers. They all take notes of what your position is on stuff. And start telling them what you feel, and not only what you, the people that you don't agree with or their votes, but it's even so important, even more important, to call and thank them when they are doing a good job, and let them know that they're being appreciated too for their actions. But I think that's where it starts. And I would even call one of their offices, and if there's a local person that you like, call and see what you can do to help them around their office, and start that way.
That's great.
Question for you is, how can we get more young people? We've all got busy lives, you know. You know, everyone's got to work. You got to work two jobs to be able to afford an apartment, or, you know, everyone's busy. And
it's an excellent question, because I think young people, their activism is on the phone, and they have trouble translating that into the real world. I feel like get some young ambassadors to go out to places where young people are, and then put out flyers and start talking to people, and it's got to be a personal connection first. And then if we can get young activists involved now, then they will be kind of like you have been off and on their whole lives.
Right. And there's a lot of reason for them to fight.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to my show, K-Voice of Resistance, on the Crab Diving Network. That's at crabdiving.com, C-R-A-B-D-I-V-I-N-G.com. That's one word. Under the K-Voice tab, or download my show as a podcast. And you can also find my show on Citizen Truth at citizentruth.org. Follow me on Twitter at Kelly the Voice. And, of course, follow me on Facebook at K-Voice of Resistance. All right, take care of yourselves out there. And as always, resist.
Change will not come if we wait for some other person, or if we wait for some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for.